Hi, I'm Marco Werman. All of us in the newsroom are used to being on deadline, and right now is no exception. We are officially in the home stretch before our fundraiser ends on June 30th. Many listeners in the last few weeks have responded with words of encouragement and, yes, financial support. I can't tell you how much it means to all of us. Take this note from a listener named Phyllis. Thank you so much for your creation and contributions, she writes. A huge contribution to world understanding. Much needed. Thank you and warm good wishes. Thank you so much, Phyllis. Join Phyllis and so many other listeners by going to theworld.org/give and make your gift today. Time is running out before June 30th, so please don't wait. That's theworld.org/give or check out the link in our episode notes. Thank you again and be well. NATO 2.0. The U.S. will be putting more troops in Eastern Europe on behalf of the alliance. A clear message to Mr. Putin.
That distant sound you hear could be his head exploding in frustration for the unintended consequences of his invasion. But he's not going to pick a fight with NATO.
Also today, in India, more unrest between Muslims and Hindus. Another sign of religious polarization under Prime Minister Modi.
Some of Prime Minister Modi's most ardent supporters believe India should be a Hindu nation, not a secular state like it is now.
I'm Marco Werman, and houseboats in Cairo have long been moored to the banks of the Nile. Now officials are ripping them out.
It's so picturesque. It's really hard to imagine Cairo without these boats.
A lifestyle vanishes. I'm Marco Werman. That's all ahead today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us this Thursday. NATO is more united than ever, so said President Joe Biden today at the NATO summit in Madrid.
At this summit, we rallied our alliances to meet both the direct threats of Russia poses to Europe and the systemic challenges that China poses to a rules-based world order.
Biden also said that the world has changed and NATO is changing as well. To discuss some of those changes, we turn to James Stavridis. He's a retired Navy admiral and the former NATO Supreme Allied Commander. Admiral, you commanded NATO forces from 2009 to 2013. Coming out of this NATO summit, how could NATO change?
I think three big things to focus on. Number one, calls out Russia as a direct military threat. Back in 2010, we still talked about trying to work with Russia. That's no longer the case in 2022 for obvious reasons. Number two, China. The alliance is not postulating China as a military threat, but certainly as a significant strategic competitor. Look for NATO to be looking toward Asia. And of note, Marco, Japan, South Korea, Australia, and New Zealand all attended the summit as observers. And then third and finally, a bigger premium on cybersecurity and the growing chance that a nation like Russia, for example, might come after the alliance in the wake of Ukraine in that regard. There's three big changes. There are some others, but those are the three I would focus on.
There are a few I want to get into there. Let me put this to you first. President Biden announced that there will be an increased U.S. military presence in Eastern Europe, a new permanent base in Poland, more troop rotations in the Baltic countries. From a military perspective, what does all that mean? What new capabilities will the U.S. and NATO now have?
Well, it puts all of these tools at the fingertips of my successor as Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. And I must say, in particular, the uplift from 40,000 on alert troops to now it looks like it's going to be 300,000 on alert troops. That's not troops that are permanently forward based, but they are immediately available to the Supreme Allied Commander. When you couple that, Marco, with your point, a 3-star Army headquarters forward permanently in Poland, big rotational brigade combat teams into the Baltics, also into Romania and Bulgaria. And let's not forget, says the Admiral, the sea. We're going to add 2 more Arleigh Burke-class destroyers en route to Spain, and in the air, 2 more squadrons of the absolute top fighter in the world, the JSF, Joint Strike Fighter, F-35 Lightning. This is a lot of firepower headed toward Europe.
So as you said, the top takeaway from the NATO summit is calling out Russia. So along with the other military capabilities, Russia must see this as an escalation. What are the fears of NATO and Russia spiraling into a larger war now? How's that being weighed?
Personally, I don't think it is likely that we will see Russia decide that this is a good time to confront NATO. Let's face it, they have their hands full fighting the 14th largest army in the world. That would be the Ukrainians. Granted, the Ukrainians have been given an awful lot of military equipment by the West, but Russia is hardly a poster child for a highly capable military at this point. So to think that Putin will be angered by the new military capability on the part of the alliance, or even the addition of Sweden and Finland to the alliance, which looks almost certain, he may be upset. That distant sound you hear could be his head exploding in frustration for the unintended consequences of his invasion. But he's not going to pick a fight with NATO.
I mean, that is an optimistic outlook. What if Russia strikes a U.S. weapons shipment on Polish territory? What would NATO actually do? What would they be prescribed to do?
We would respond in a proportionate way. We would not launch into a massive campaign against Russia. We would, however, increase our level of defenses. I would guess the president would look at a wide range of options to respond. It might include cyber responses. It might include strikes against Russian base from which such an attack was launched. It could include providing even more capabilities, say high-end fighter aircraft to the Ukrainians. I think all of those would be on the table. That's why it would be a very bad move for Vladimir Putin to try and escalate by attacking within a NATO border. I don't see it.
I'm speaking with retired Navy Admiral and former NATO Supreme Allied Commander James Stavridis. A defense correspondent I follow, Frank Gardner with the BBC, said from Madrid that Putin's invasion of Ukraine has had a 50,000-volt shock on the alliance. Was NATO prepared for this dramatic, non-theoretical action taken by Putin in the 21st century? Was this in the playbook?
It was certainly in the playbook in Warsaw, in Tallinn, Estonia, in Lithuania, in Bulgaria, in Romania. Those former Warsaw Pact countries who spent decades with a Russian boot on their throat in the Warsaw Pact, they knew Russia. And in the West, and I include our own nation in that category, we took a softer approach toward Russia, hoping that they would, in fact, over time, want to integrate with the West, want to cooperate more than they would want to confront. That just hasn't turned out to be the case. Our Eastern European colleagues were right. I think the further west you go, the bigger the shock felt. In the East, it's more, I told you so.
So returning to NATO and Russia, many of the decisions made at this Madrid summit were a function of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Help us understand how any of these new policies actually help Ukraine.
First and foremost, it requires Russia to expend its resources, its intelligence, its cyber activities, its border activities. Those are fewer Russian troops that are available to go down into his invasion of Ukraine. Secondly, when you show this kind of solidarity in the alliance, I think it has an overall effect of increasing the tendency to want to help the Ukrainians. And third and finally, Marco, it's follow the money. Now that many of the NATO nations are finally hitting that 2% of gross domestic product spending, there's more resources in their military budget that gives more capability and capacity to aid the Ukrainians, which I think will follow.
So obviously no war goes on forever, Admiral. What can be done to find a pathway to ending this war, at least getting to a ceasefire?
Number one, what we just talked about, putting the tools in the hands of the Ukrainians so they can be in the best possible position if and when this does come to a negotiation. Number two, continue to press on the sanctions. They're going to take time. It'll require a lot of rewiring in the global energy networks, for example. But over time, that will be part of working Russia toward a desire to negotiate. Number three, give the Ukrainians the ability to reach out and touch the Black Sea fleet. They have to keep Odessa open. We need that grain to get out for humanitarian reasons. All of that will put pressure on Russia. And then fourth and finally, encourage those who appear willing to try and move toward a negotiation. I'll say that President Erdogan of Turkey has been very active in trying to bring the sides together. We ought to encourage him and others who are willing to try and find a path to a negotiation.
James Stavridis is a retired Navy admiral and the former NATO Supreme Allied Commander. His latest book is To Risk It All, Nine Conflicts and the Crucible of Decision. Admiral, thank you very much.
Pleasure, Marco. Thank you.
The financial crisis in Lebanon is on everyone's minds there. One odd thing, no one can seem to agree on how much the currency is worth. The Lebanese government says one U.S. dollar is worth 1,500 Lebanese pounds, but on the street, that number is thousands more. The World's Duri Buscarin reports from Beirut on why this is happening and what it means for a country experiencing one of the worst economic meltdowns in modern history.
Okay, so I have a $10 bill, and on the official exchange, that would be 15,000 Lebanese pounds. I'm standing outside of a money exchange office in central Beirut. 15,000 is about what you'll pay for a small bottle of water in Lebanon. But if I exchange it at the unofficial rate, it's a better deal. I go inside, pass the bill under a plastic barrier. Okay, merci beaucoup. Bye. He hands me a stack of colorful bills, keeping a small cut. And I now have 285,000 Lebanese pounds. I later use this to buy a mountain of fried pumpkin kibbeh, hummus, and cilantro-spiced potatoes at an outdoor cafe, which for $10 seems great. But for most Lebanese earners, a meal like this is a luxury, thanks to out-of-control inflation.
Imagine your salary now, it's like $300, your monthly salary. You sleep and wake up, second day is $200.
Mustafa Fakhro is a finance manager in Beirut.
And we are living a very hard situation here in Lebanon because of the exchange rate.
Fakhro earns in Lebanese pounds, but has to pay his suppliers in U.S. dollars. So he changes money at an exchange office to get the black market rate.
It's like monopoly at some levels. We are under the mercy of Isabet.
His friend Hassan Sinu breaks in.
The money gangs.
Sinu works with Fakhro as an accountant. He says he sees no future for himself or any young people in Lebanon.
I don't know how to say it, but it's killing us. Yeah, it's a daily death.
In 1997, the Lebanese government locked in its exchange rate at 1,500 Lebanese pounds to the dollar, and the currencies were used interchangeably for a long time. This policy was intended to help Lebanon rebuild after the civil war, says Rosalie Berthier, a macroeconomist working for Synapse, a Beirut-based think tank. It reassured investors that they'd be paid back in a currency that would hold its value.
It ballooned the debt, that's for sure. Also created a lot of inequality.
By the fall of 2019, interest payments consumed almost half of Lebanon's public revenues. With the government defaulting on its debt and the economy in shambles, people took to the streets in what is now known as Lebanon's October Revolution.
You know, you had an economy that was built on speculation debts, real estates, and, you know, this fictitious idea that you could just decide this is the exchange rate of a currency. And now you have multiple exchange rates because this is not a promise that the central bank or banks can hold anymore.
Banks were unable to pay back people who wanted to withdraw dollars from their savings accounts, so they closed their doors. Now there's just one entity that's forced to pay the official exchange rate, Berthier says, the state. And that means it has almost no money to pay its public workers.
We picked basil out, the good leaves, we put them as garnishes.
When I meet bartender Hassan Mansour, he's sorting basil for craft cocktails under the light of a cell phone. Because of the crisis, the electricity in this neighborhood doesn't turn on until 5:30. So that's when the bar opens. Mansour likes this job.
The ambience, the vibes, it's energetic, it's full of life.
But he's actually moonlighting here. He's also a cancer research doctor, specializing in genetics. But because his work at the hospital is in the public sector, he and his colleagues rarely get their paychecks. When they do, it's a tiny amount.
Yeah, even if we take some cases, you can say it's about 200 or 300,000 Lebanese pounds.
I realize that 300,000 Lebanese pounds is about what I got when I exchanged just $10 at the place down the street. Like Mansour, lots of doctors and nurses are cutting back their hours or leaving Lebanon entirely. And while he worries about his patients, he has a family to feed.
As a bartender, more or less my pay is about between 7 million and 8 million Lebanese pounds. That's without the tips. If I want to include the tips, it can reach up to 15 million.
Or about 500 US dollars a month. Not a lot, but enough.
For The World, I'm Dari Biscarin in Beirut.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court sharply curtailed the authority of the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, to regulate greenhouse gases. The court's ruling will limit the ability of the U.S. to meet its emissions targets set out in the Paris Climate Accord back in 2015. Here's what then-President Obama said in Paris back then.
I've come here personally as the leader of the world's largest economy and the second largest emitter to say that the United States of America not only recognizes our role in creating this problem, we embrace our responsibility to do something about it.
That was 7 years ago. What about now? The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler is here to help us unpack today's Supreme Court ruling. So, Carolyn, you were there in Paris when President Obama laid out the U.S. pledge to curb carbon emissions. What was the mood then?
It was very optimistic. The U.S. and China had come together ahead of the summit to pave the way for this first-time agreement on how to tackle climate change from countries all over the world. So it was quite optimistic. But since then, the U.S. has met with significant roadblocks to meeting its own targets that it set, from the Trump administration pulling the U.S. out of the climate accords to legislation not being able to get passed through Congress. And sources today, including someone I talked to, Bill Hare, director of climate analytics, say this is the latest and a big one, a big setback.
Look, I think the Supreme Court decision is the latest in a series of blows to the U.S. efforts to meet the goals that President Biden has set. And I think it looks like a very fundamental threat to the ability of the United States as a government to meet any far-reaching aims to reduce emissions.
Okay, Carolyn, what did the Supreme Court ruling actually today say?
As you said, it significantly limited the EPA's ability to regulate greenhouse gas emissions coming from power plants specifically. It is a ruling based on the Clean Power Plan, which was the Obama administration's key regulation aimed actually at meeting the Paris Agreement targets. It never went into effect due to legal challenges. And in this case, the Supreme Court ruled that the EPA does not have the authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate the energy system as a whole, which means taking some of the most ambitious measures to limit emissions off the table for the federal government, like instituting a cap and trade program for emissions. It does, however, leave the door open for requiring emission reductions at individual power plants. So there are still options for federal regulation here, but it does significantly tie the hands of the EPA.
So Justice Elena Kagan, in writing for the three dissenters, said the court appoints itself instead of Congress or the expert agency, the decision maker on climate policy. I cannot think of many things more frightening. So how does today's ruling impact the U.S. climate agenda as laid out in Paris in 2015?
It is going to make it harder for the U.S. to meet its carbon emission goals. And here's why. Under the Paris Agreement, the Biden administration has said it wants to slash greenhouse gas emissions in half by 2030. Power plants contribute about 30% of the U.S.'s greenhouse gas emissions, so there is no way that the U.S. can get there without reducing emissions from these sources. And based on existing policies that are already on the books, the U.S. is expected to only be about halfway to that goal. So without federal action specifically on power plants, the U.S. is not going to be able to uphold its end of the bargain in the Paris Agreement.
So in 2015, Obama expressed contrition for U.S. emissions and took responsibility. I mean, that was impressive. After today, what role do you imagine the U.S. will play globally?
You know, I don't think the international agenda for climate action from the U.S. is going to change a whole lot, but this is another sort of chink in the armor of U.S. credibility on its own action. So all eyes will now be looking toward this fall. That's when the Biden administration is expected to announce its own plan for regulating power plant emissions. Diplomats from around the world will be watching how the U.S. plans to do that, given the new constraints just set out by the Supreme Court. And that policy and how it goes will have an impact on the outcome of the next U.N. climate summit in November.
Mm. Carolyn Beeler, the world's environment correspondent, helping us understand the global impact of today's Supreme Court decision to limit the powers of the EPA. Carolyn, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
There was another ruling from the Supreme Court today. The court ruled in favor of the Biden administration's reversal of the Remain in Mexico program. The program forced many asylum seekers to wait for approval in Mexico rather than enter the United States. It began under President Trump. Here to tell us more is Muzaffar Shishti. He's a senior fellow with the Migration Policy Institute and director of its office at New York University School of Law. Muzaffar, your reaction, how surprised were you by this ruling?
I think people were surprised mostly because in August of last year, the Supreme Court had gone in a different direction about an earlier policy on Remain in Mexico issued in June by the Biden administration. It was a short unsigned order, but it looked like that only three liberal judges had dissented. But the fact is that there was a new policy issued by the administration in October, and the change in that policy seems was sufficient for the Supreme Court to change its opinion.
Briefly remind us how this law, Remain in Mexico policy, got put in place. Why did the Trump administration implement it?
Trump administration put it in place because they thought that letting people who arrive at our border seeking asylum is just creating a magnet for more and more people to come. And they wanted people not to be allowed into the country and instead wait in Mexico for their asylum hearings.
So is one of the takeaways from this decision that we're actually seeing the executive branch or the president as responsible for federal immigration law?
Well, the president is always responsible for immigration law. The president has a lot of leeway in immigration matters. The extent of that leeway has been subject of a lot of controversy in the last few years, frankly, both under the Republican and Democratic administrations. Where the court falls on it really goes from in all directions. And I think the general jurisprudence from the Roberts Court is that the president has a lot of authority to enforce immigration law.
So, Muzaffar, in a week that began with a tragedy in a tractor trailer truck, dozens of deaths because of human smuggling, what does this ruling effectively mean for migrants and refugees coming over from Mexico and the rest of Latin America?
It doesn't mean that people may not be sent back to Mexico. Let's just be clear. The case was that they must be sent back to Mexico. The statute under which Texas and Missouri had brought this lawsuit said that you may send people to a contiguous country. And Texas and Missouri implied that that meant must. And Supreme Court said may does not mean must. Therefore, the administration still retains the discretion of sending some people back to Mexico. It just means they're not required to do it. That means I think most of the people they will be letting into the country and having credible fear determinations, and if they meet them, sending them for asylum hearings inside the country, and paroling most of them is what's going to happen.
How big a win was this for the Biden administration? Do you think it might empower President Biden to spend the capital and tackle other immigration reforms?
Any new administration should have the ability to put in place its policies. And here were these series of challenges, mostly by red states, on any policy that the Biden administration was putting in place. This is a sign in the other direction that folks, you cannot challenge everything that the administration does. There are limits to that. And this is an important signal for Biden administration to feel a little more emboldened about its policies.
Muzaffar Shishti is a senior fellow with the Migration Policy Institute. Thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court sharply curtailed the authority of the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, to regulate greenhouse gases. The court's ruling will limit the ability of the U.S. to meet its emissions targets set out in the Paris Climate Accord back in 2015. Here's what then-President Obama said in Paris back then.
I've come here personally as the leader of the world's largest economy and the second largest emitter to say that the United States of America not only recognizes our role in creating this problem, we embrace our responsibility to do something about it.
That was 7 years ago. What about now? The World's Environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler is here to help us unpack today's Supreme Court ruling. So, Carolyn, you were there in Paris when President Obama laid out the U.S. pledge to curb carbon emissions. What was the mood then?
It was very optimistic. The U.S. and China had come together ahead of the summit to pave the way for this first-time agreement on how to tackle climate change from countries all over the world. So it was quite optimistic. But since then, the U.S. has met with significant roadblocks to meeting its own targets that it set, from the Trump administration pulling the U.S. out of the climate accords to legislation not being able to get passed through Congress. And sources today, including someone I talked to, Bill Hare, director of climate analytics, say this is the latest and a big one, a big setback.
Look, I think the Supreme Court decision is the latest in a series of blows to the US efforts to meet the goals that President Biden has set. And I think it looks like a very fundamental threat to the ability of the United States as a government to meet any far-reaching aims to reduce emissions.
Okay, Carolyn, what did the Supreme Court ruling actually today say?
As you said, it significantly limited the EPA's ability to regulate greenhouse gas emissions coming from power plants specifically. It is a ruling based on the Clean Power Plan, which was the Obama administration's key regulation aimed actually at meeting the Paris Agreement targets. It never went into effect due to legal challenges. And in this case, the Supreme Court ruled that the EPA does not have the authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate the energy system as a whole, which means taking some of the most ambitious measures to limit emissions off the table for the federal government, like instituting a cap and trade program for emissions. It does, however, leave the door open for requiring emission reductions at individual power plants. So there are still options for federal regulation here, but it does significantly tie the hands of the EPA.
So Justice Elena Kagan, in writing for the three dissenters, said the court appoints itself instead of Congress or the expert agency, the decision maker on climate policy. I cannot think of many things more frightening. So how does today's ruling impact the U.S. climate agenda as laid out in Paris in 2015?
It is going to make it harder for the U.S. to meet its carbon emission goals. And here's why. Under the Paris Agreement, the Biden administration has said it wants to slash greenhouse gas emissions in half by 2030. Power plants contribute about 30% of the U.S.'s greenhouse gas emissions, so there is no way that the U.S. can get there without reducing emissions from these sources. And based on existing policies that are already on the books, the U.S. is expected to only be about halfway to that goal. So without federal action specifically on power plants, the U.S. is not going to be able to uphold its end of the bargain in the Paris Agreement.
So in 2015, Obama expressed contrition for U.S. emissions and took responsibility. I mean, that was impressive. After today, what role do you imagine the U.S. will play globally?
You know, I don't think the international agenda for climate action from the U.S. is going to change a whole lot, but this is another sort of chink in the armor of U.S. credibility on its own action. So all eyes will now be looking toward this fall. That's when the Biden administration is expected to announce its own plan for regulating power plant emissions. Diplomats from around the world will be watching how the U.S. plans to do that, given the new constraints just set out by the Supreme Court. And that policy and how it goes will have an impact on the outcome of the next U.N. climate summit in November.
Mm. Carolyn Beeler, the world's environment correspondent, helping us understand the global impact of today's Supreme Court decision to limit the powers of the EPA. Carolyn, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
There was another ruling from the Supreme Court today. The court ruled in favor of the Biden administration's reversal of the Remain in Mexico program. The program forced many asylum seekers to wait for approval in Mexico rather than enter the United States. It began under President Trump. Here to tell us more is Muzaffar Shishti. He's a senior fellow with the Migration Policy Institute and director of its office at New York University School of Law. Muzaffar, your reaction, how surprised were you by this ruling?
I think people were surprised mostly because in August of last year, the Supreme Court had gone in a different direction about an earlier policy on Remain in Mexico issued in June by the Biden administration. It was a short unsigned order, but it looked like that only three liberal judges had dissented. But the fact is that there was a new policy issued by the administration in October, and the change in that policy seems was sufficient for the Supreme Court to change its opinion.
Briefly remind us how this law, Remain in Mexico policy, got put in place. Why did the Trump administration implement it?
Trump administration put it in place because they thought that letting people who arrive at our border seeking asylum is just creating a magnet for more and more people to come. And they wanted people not to be allowed into the country and instead wait in Mexico for their asylum hearings.
So is one of the takeaways from this decision that we're actually seeing the executive branch or the president as responsible for federal immigration law?
Well, the president is always responsible for immigration law. The president has a lot of leeway in immigration matters. The extent of that leeway has been subject of a lot of controversy in the last few years, frankly, both under the Republican and Democratic administrations. Where the court falls on it really goes from in all directions. And I think the general jurisprudence from the Roberts Court is that the president has a lot of authority to enforce immigration law.
So, Muzaffar, in a week that began with a tragedy in a tractor-trailer truck, dozens of deaths because of human smuggling, what does this ruling effectively mean for migrants and refugees coming over from Mexico and the rest of Latin America?
It doesn't mean that people may not be sent back to Mexico. Let's just be clear. The case was that they must be sent back to Mexico. The statute under which Texas and Missouri had brought this lawsuit said that you may send people to a contiguous country. And Texas and Missouri implied that that meant must. And Supreme Court said may does not mean must. Therefore, the administration still retains the discretion of sending some people back to Mexico. It just means they're not required to do it. That means, I think, most of the people they will be letting into the country and having credible fear determinations, and if they meet them, sending them for asylum hearings inside the country, and paroling most of them is what's going to happen.
How big a win was this for the Biden administration? Do you think it might empower President Biden to spend the capital and tackle other immigration reforms?
Any new administration should have the ability to put in place its policies. And here were these series of challenges, mostly by red states, on any policy that the Biden administration was putting in place. This is a sign in the other direction that folks, you cannot challenge everything that the administration does. There are limits to that. And this is an important signal for the Biden administration to feel a little more emboldened about its policies.
Muzaffar Shishti is a senior fellow with the Migration Policy Institute. Thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you so much for having me.
In Cuba, a popular song became a rallying cry for protesters. Patria y vida. People were arrested for those words. Now the musicians behind the song are being punished too.
Because they didn't want these messages of liberation and freedom spreading into the population.
That's coming up this half hour on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In northern India today, thousands of people took to the streets after the brutal murder of a Hindu tailor. Many of the protesters in the city of Udaipur carried saffron flags, a holy color in Hinduism. They were calling for the death penalty for two Muslim men accused of beheading the tailor, Kanhaiyalal Taili. The incident has pushed religious tensions in India to a boiling point. Joining us now is freelance journalist Sushmita Pathak. She's in Meerut, not far from India's capital. Sushmita, tell us how all of this unfolded.
So it started with two videos that surfaced on social media on Tuesday. The first one shows the victim, who was a tailor, taking measurements of a bearded Muslim man in his shop. A few seconds later, the man attacks the tailor suddenly. There's a commotion. The camera falls, and you can hear the tailor's screams in the background. It was really horrifying. In the second video, two Muslim men claim responsibility for the murder. They introduce themselves and describe how they beheaded the Hindu tailor. They're holding what looks like meat cleavers. They're essentially boasting about the murder. And they also threaten to kill India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi.
That's pretty extraordinary. I mean, what else was said in this video?
Basically, the men said that this was an act of revenge. revenge for supporting someone who insulted Prophet Muhammad. The tailor had allegedly shared a post on social media supporting Nupur Sharma. She was a member of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's party, who made derogatory remarks on TV last month about Prophet Muhammad and his wife. That incident led to a huge backlash from Muslim nations and sparked protests by Muslims in India too. There were counter-protests also from Hindus who supported Nupur Sharma, and it seems like the tailor was targeted for supporting her.
So, Sushmita, religious tensions have been rising in India for some time. So, as intense and tragic as this incident is, it's not an isolated one, right?
Right. This didn't happen in a vacuum. Like you said, religious polarization has been rising in India under Modi, who is seen as a Hindu nationalist leader. Some of Prime Minister Modi's most ardent supporters believe India should be a Hindu nation, not a secular state like it is now. Members of his party often make anti-Muslim remarks. There have been a number of incidents and policies in recent years that have disproportionately affected Muslims, you know, from mob lynchings and attacks on interfaith couples to arrests of prominent Muslim figures. Just earlier this week, police arrested a high-profile Muslim journalist and fact-checker over something he tweeted many years ago. And things really came to a head last month with the remarks about the Prophet.
Right. So going back to Udaipur, what is the situation now? How tense are things there?
Udaipur has been on edge ever since the videos surfaced. Internet was suspended there. The government is rushing additional police because there are fears of riots. The tailor's funeral took place yesterday, and it was attended by a huge crowd. Today also, thousands joined a protest march demanding justice for the victim. It was organized by several Hindu groups. In other cities also, there were demonstrations calling for action against Islamist jihad. And that's how some people are seeing this incident.
Right. And what are authorities saying about the murder?
Authorities are treating it as an act of terrorism. The National Investigation Agency, which is a high-level federal agency, has taken over the case. Both the men in the video have been taken for questioning. There were some reports linking one of them to an Islamist group in Pakistan, but Pakistan has denied that.
Given that India is a Hindu majority country and this is a federal agency that is going to be investigating it, is it expected to be an impartial investigation?
It's really hard to say how the investigation is going to unfold. I mean, over the recent years, there's a feeling among, you know, activists that investigations by the federal agency that involve Muslim figures have not been impartial. So, yeah, there is a sense that maybe this will not be treated like that.
So whatever this investigation finds, this federal investigation, what has this done to the wider tensions across India?
It has just added fuel to the fire. There are very real fears that this could push religious tensions beyond their breaking point. India is a tinderbox right now. Muslim groups have condemned the attack, but we'll just have to see what happens. I spoke to political scientist Nilanjan Sarkar, and he says those who want to foment Hindu-Muslim tensions are actually going to use this incident.
There's political mileage to be gained out of every small event. It isn't that we haven't seen these kinds of events from time to time. It's that today, you know, you can have a very local event, but it can have national implications.
And so this might further embolden Hindu nationalists who see Muslims as a threat.
When Modi became prime minister in 2014, there were fears that Hindu nationalism would rise. How much of the current atmosphere is attributed to Modi himself?
A lot of it, just as Nilanjan Sarkar was saying, you know, Hindu-Muslim tensions have existed in India for decades, you know, since independence, even before independence. Since Modi came to power in 2014, there's a sense that it's really coming very close to the breaking point. The examples of policies or actions that have impacted Muslims disproportionately, the list is really endless.
Troubling times. Sushmita Pathak is a freelance journalist in India, joining us from outside Delhi. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
In Egypt, after years of threatening to remove houseboats along the banks of the Nile, the Egyptian government is finally making its move. Barges with diggers moved in this week to start tearing them down. Scenes from the river today, owners watching their homes being broken apart as they plead with Cairo authorities. As the world's Shirin Jafari reports, the residents say the iconic houseboats are not just their homes. They are part of what gives Cairo its character.
On the banks of the Nile River in Cairo sit about 30 houseboats, some of them 100 years old. They're more like floating homes attached to the banks, but also movable. Among them, there's one that has light blue walls and white lattice railings. 88-year-old Madame Ikhlas is the owner. She lives on the boat with her dogs, cat, and several geese. I was born on a houseboat, she says in this interview with an Egyptian media outlet. My siblings and I were born and raised on a houseboat. We had a happy life, she continues. We went on outings on the Nile. We had fish for breakfast, she says. Maybe that's why I was blessed with good health. This houseboat is a small oasis for Madame Ikhlas in the middle of the chaos of Cairo, home to about 10 million people. Writer Yasmin Al-Rashidi had just returned from a visit with Madame Ikhlas when I spoke with her this week.
She doesn't know anything but living on the Nile. You know, she feels that if she lives between brick walls, she will die.
Madame Ikhlas and other owners of the houseboats on the Nile have received eviction notices from the government, and they're shell-shocked.
You're 88 years old. You have 6 days to pack up your lifelong home. You don't really have anywhere else to go.
The government says they have given residents plenty of notice. Ayman Anwar of the Administration for the Protection of the Nile River said in an interview on Egyptian TV this week that the president issued a decree in 2020 prohibiting all residential houseboats on the Nile. Another official, Mohammed Abdul Ati, the irrigation minister, publicly stated that the houseboats were built without proper government permits, making them illegal. This week, demolition teams got to work. Omar Hamilton, a British-Egyptian filmmaker, has been watching from his house on the river.
Today was the second day that the Ministry of Irrigation has been towing away boats. Well, we got a destruction order saying that our boat was going to be removed or destroyed on July the 4th. And, yeah, we've been watching the boats one by one disappear.
To the troops who have had some in the Western Desert, the converted River Nile boat, Arabia, is a dream ship come true.
The houseboats have been a part of the visual and cultural landscape of Cairo for more than 100 years. Some of the most popular scenes in old movies have been filmed on these boats, and the British troops stayed in them during World War II. This is why owners and residents say if these houses go, part of the city's heritage is lost. Writer Yasmin Al-Rashidi says the houseboat demolitions are part of a worrying trend.
Unfortunately, in the past 2 years, this government, led really by the army, has been on a rampage, bulldozing down tens of thousands of kilometers of old buildings, heritage, cemeteries, and in its place are coming up either highways and bridges or high-rises.
Rashidi and Hamilton tell me that the government hasn't clearly stated what it wants to do with the space, but some residents have been told that they can keep their homes only if they turn them into cafes and hotels. That's out of the question for Madame Ikhlas, Rashidi says.
She'll never turn it into something commercial. It's her home. It's her entire life.
Activists are trying to stop the demolitions. A petition to save the houseboats got more than 4,000 signatures. The Egyptian media has picked up the story too. But Yasmin Al-Rashidi says she's aware of the risks involved in taking on the government. In the past few years, President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has drastically cracked down on dissent.
On the one hand, of course, there are risks involved with a certain kind of, you know, community organizing. On the other hand, I think that we're at this point where we have no choice.
She says it's hard to imagine Cairo without these iconic boats. And if the government continues the demolitions, it will change the character of the river she has always known. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Let me point you to some of our economics reporting you might have missed on the show. A small business owner in Russia is trying to stay afloat by relying on cryptocurrency in a time when sanctions have blocked a lot of international payment systems. And in the U.S., the hospitality industry is welcoming back foreign student workers for the summer after a couple of years of COVID disruption. Find those stories and more on our website, theworld.org. Two Latin Grammy winners were sentenced to long prison terms in Cuba this month. Their crime? Composing and recording a song.
Y eres tú mi canto de sirena.
porque con tu voz se van mis penas.
The song Patria y Vida became an anthem of demonstrations that broke out in Cuba last July, the largest anti-government protests on the island in decades, with people there demanding an end to economic and political repression. The World's TV Saizea reports.
Cuba has a long and rich history of music inspired by politics. You can find veiled references to frustration, hope, pain, and discontent with the regime in the music of many artists, like exile singer Celia Cruz.
Por si acaso no regreso, yo me llevo tu bandera.
She's lamenting she can't go back home.
Liberada no te viera.
Famous songwriter Silvio Rodriguez dedicated many songs to the ideals of the Cuban Revolution, including references to his time in the military.
Ojalá pase algo que te borre de pronto, una luz cegadora, un disparo de nieve.
And the underground Cuban rap movement in the 90s denounced social injustices. Here's the singer in the band Los Orillas saying he can't hide his sadness about what's happening in his country. But one of the most direct critiques to the Cuban regime came last year in the song Patria y Vida. Patria y Vida means homeland or life. It's a play on words of the revolutionary slogan Patria o Muerte, or Homeland or Death. The song was released early last year by a group of Cuban artists. Some recorded their parts in Cuba while others were in exile. The song demands freedom for the Cuban people and accuses the government of destroying the quality of life there. No more lies. My people are asking for freedom, the song says. It was transformed into a rallying cry. This is from July last year, when thousands of protesters took the streets chanting Patria y Vida. But criticizing the government is illegal in Cuba. Close to 1,500 people were arrested during these protests, and half of them are still in jail. That's according to 11J, a nonprofit that tracks detentions in the country. The risk extended to the songwriters, too.
Soy el Funky Style, aquí tienen mi firma, y ustedes están sobrando, ya no le queda nada.
This is Cuban rapper Eliezer Márquez, known as El Funky. He and artists Michael Castillo and Luis Manuel Otero were the only performers who worked on the song Patria y Vida while in Cuba. And they were all arrested last year. Márquez was able to leave the country, but back home, his friends are facing a different fate. Last week, a Cuban court sentenced Otero to 5 years in prison and Castillo to 9.
Michael y Luis están presos por ese poder de convocatoria que tan grande que tiene.
Márquez says his friends are in prison because they have a big reach. The government is afraid of them, he says.
Me siento súper triste, súper mal. Es impotencia, es la palabra. Es una impotencia.
I feel very sad and frustrated because no one can do anything for them, he says. He tells me his friends are in a high security cell and they are not in good health.
The regime basically has given Cubans three options if they don't want to go along with the dictatorship.
This is John Suarez from Center for a Free Cuba in Washington, D.C.
One option is prison, the other is death, and the other is exile.
He says the Cuban regime was terrified by the song, and now people can be arrested just for listening to it.
Because they didn't want these messages of liberation and freedom spreading into the population.
Patria y Vida now has 11 million views on YouTube and won 2 Latin Grammy Awards in November. I asked musicologist Susan Thomas what's so special about this song. She studies Cuban music and its relation to culture and politics at the University of Colorado.
The song is brilliant. It's openly critical, and it's mass mediated, and it pairs artists who have had international careers, and that's a dangerous combination. And that is something we haven't seen before.
Groups including Amnesty International, Human Rights Foundation, and Freedom House have denounced the lack of a fair trial for Castillo and Otero and are calling for their immediate release. For The World, I am Tibisa Itzea.
Con la incertidumbre de pasado plantado, 15 amigos puestos, listos para morirnos, izamos la bandera todavía, la represión del régimen al día.
It was the largest ever peacetime attack on French soil, the bombings and shooting spree that seized Paris on a balmy November evening in 2015. Islamic State extremists killed more than 130 people that night, most at the Bataclan concert hall. They also targeted Parisians at cafes and at the National Stadium. This week, a landmark trial of the assailants, the biggest trial in modern French history, drew to a close. Among the many survivors who offered testimony was Arthur de Nouveau. He was at the Bataclan that evening listening to music by the Eagles of Death Metal when three men burst into the hall and started shooting into the crowd. De Nouveau now heads the victim support group called Life for Paris. He joins us from Paris. Thank you very much, Mr. De Nouveau, for being with us.
Thank you for giving me some airtime.
Mr. De Nouveau, this trial was a massive undertaking held in a large, specially built courtroom just for this trial. Was there a moment or image in the 10 months of this case where the drama and power of this judicial process was really kind of crystallized for you?
On the first day when we all entered that room and the accused were brought in and the court came in and we all had to stand up, you know, there is a moment when you realize that this is all happening and that you're going to breathe the same air as the terrorists for the next 10 months. And that's a sudden realization, which is very strong.
Mm. So Salah Abdeslam, the lone survivor among the assailants, was found guilty of murder and sentenced to life without parole. That was just yesterday. 19 others also convicted. What did those verdicts mean for you?
You know, I was not very attached to the exact sentence for each accused. I was just happy that the trial was coming to an end, that we had given ourselves all the opportunities to understand better what had happened and why it had happened. And so yesterday was closure, but I was really not focused on, okay, that accused has got 20 years or 30 years or life. It was more saying, okay, our justice system has worked. It has not failed us. And we were able to convict these guys using the same basic law somehow that is used for everyone.
When defendant Salah Abdeslam took the stand, he spoke about his radicalism and he cried. He apologized to victims and pleaded with judges to forgive his mistakes, as he said. What went through your mind as you watched him testify?
When he said that, you know, he wanted to apologize, I felt something I had felt myself, and that's the weirdest part of it all, is that I felt like he had survivor's guilt, you know, because he was supposed to blow himself up. And he found himself in a cell. And you felt like he was not so much apologizing to victims, but apologizing to himself for putting himself in such a situation. And so I was deeply moved by the internal struggle you can see inside of him. And, you know, that made him very human. And that's something I needed to feel.
Did it matter to you, Arthur, whether the defendants showed remorse for their actions?
Yeah, somehow having the defendants showing remorse makes you believe that the trial was useful, you know, that it was important to have victims testifying and that we could still move them. I think the worst thing would have been if they had stayed silent the whole trial, not said anything. Because, you know, just showing our anger or our pain and having nothing in return would have felt very inhuman.
If I can ask you, how prominent are the memories of that night just in your day-to-day life?
Memories of that night, they've been very prominent for a year and a half. And then through a lot of psychological work, I could put them aside. So I can bring them back if I want to, but they don't show up unannounced. That's what has given me the possibility to go on and lead my life as normally as possible.
I mean, you've led this organization, Life for Paris, a survivors organization. Are these things that you discuss as trauma with other people that you meet through Life for Paris?
Of course, we share the experiences, we share the trauma, but we mostly share the new path of life we are on. And no one knows what the next step is going to be, but when you take 500 people and ask them, the average answer is not too bad. And that's what we talk about mostly. It's, okay, what have I done that works? What will we do that we feel like will work? And that's the kind of conversation we have.
Mm. I mean, France has changed a lot since these events in 2015. Have the changes been for the good?
That's the best question I've been asked. Yeah, I think there have been a lot of changes in France due to the November 13th attacks, and not all of them have been for good. And I think this trial must not hide the fact that we have to wonder, are we a better country now? Did adding up a lot of strict security laws do anything good for our country? Do we feel safer now? That's not very clear, and that's a debate that has not been opened up yet.
You say it's not very clear. Where do your answers take you?
I think my answer is we put on a lot of laws that are efficient, but we've given up a lot of liberties for them. And in exchange for that, we haven't got much. We still have French kids stuck in northern Syria because their parents are terrorists. And these kids, they are victims of terrorism as well, but we're still too afraid to bring them back because a lot of people believe they will become terrorists as well. So I think somehow we haven't done enough or we haven't done it right if we can't treat these kids.
The French legal system doesn't typically film trials, but this one was, and the footage will be made public in 50 years. When you think about that film being viewed by the next generation, a half century from now, what do you imagine?
I would like that film to be shown earlier than in 50 years. But if it's in 50 years, I hope it will somehow show how resilient and how strong we were and how we made everything possible to keep our head up high through all of this ordeal and through all of this trial. And I hope they will understand that we have never given up and that even in the face of the worst attacks, there is still a lot of hope to be held.
Finally, what will become of the survivors organization that you lead, Life for Paris?
Life for Paris will dissolve itself for the 10th anniversary of the attacks. Because we've created this because being a victim is so passive that we wanted to have some action and to decide things for ourselves. But all the goals we had set in terms of memory, in terms of reparation, in terms of justice, we've come to realize that we are close to having realized. And so we give ourselves 3 years to do all of that, to close this chapter, and to say, okay, we needed a crutch, we don't need it anymore, let's get back to our normal lives.
Arthur Denouveau heads the victim support group Life for Paris. He survived the attack on the Bataclan in Paris in 2015. He's been speaking with us about the trial of Islamic State extremists convicted this week for those attacks in 2015. Mr. Denouveau, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow. One last note before we go. The daily coverage you rely on from The World, whether it's the podcast, broadcast, or at theworld.org, it's available for everyone for free thanks to listener support. We're coming to the end of our fundraiser on June 30th. If you've been thinking about donating but just haven't done it yet, please make your gift today. It only takes a minute, but it helps our entire team to produce the show every day. Every single gift will help us reach our goal of raising $25,000. Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give. Thank you so much.